Hi, I'm John Harwood, your host for Bedeviled, a podcast about American democracy from the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. We bring you conversations with politicians, journalists, and academics about preserving the delicate balance of our fractious system of self-government. For the first time in modern U.S. history, the 2020 election and its aftermath put the future of our democracy in doubt. An unbroken record for transferring power peacefully after free and fair elections had made America a model for the world. The violent January 6th insurrection on behalf of Donald Trump broke that record. President Joe Biden has warned ever since that another Trump candidacy would deepen the threat to democracy. Vice President Kamala Harris, after replacing Biden as her party's candidate, has emphasized other issues more. But voices outside the battle of candidates have continued sounding the alarm. One of them is Ian Bassin, a former lawyer in Barack Obama's White House who heads the nonpartisan watchdog group Protect Democracy. With early voting already underway in some states and Election Day less than 7 weeks out, Ian Bassin is our guest for this new episode of Bedeviled. Let me start by asking whether you're satisfied with the amount of focus on democracy in the campaign. It's sort of ebbed and flowed, and there's disagreement on how important it is to talk about. Do you think it's getting talked about enough?
I generally do. Obviously, given the stakes for democracy and given the risks facing democracy, I think there are compelling arguments to be made that you couldn't possibly talk about the stakes for our democracy. And not enough, I think not enough of the electorate is as deeply engaged in just how serious the stakes are for our democracy. But the reason I said I do is because I think we also need to understand that democracy is understood in different ways by different people, and the language that different people think of differs. And so, for example, when Biden was the nominee, he used the word democracy a lot and talked about the stakes for democracy. I think Harris has made an important and intelligent pivot, which is to actually use the word freedom more, which is really how people think about the issues that, when you and I talk about democracy, how they think about that issue, which is, what does democracy really mean? It means people having the freedom to make determinations over their own future and for us collectively as a society to make determinations over our collective future. So in a sense, I think that democracy is very much being talked about, but perhaps in words that are more compelling and more engaging. And we could talk more about what those stakes are. You and I have talked about it in the past, but I do think freedom is at the heart of the campaign right now. It's what Vice President Harris is talking about every day.
Now, we know that the overwhelming majority of voters are locked in from day one of the campaign. We have a very entrenched polarization in our politics. So how do you think this issue plays, if it does play, in people's decision either who to vote for or whether to vote at all?
Well, I think this also gets to this question of how people think about this issue of what kind of country we're going to live in and whether the people we elect to positions of power ultimately are going to be able to wield that power responsibly and consistently with our Constitution and with an eye towards preserving freedom and self-government. And when we talk about democracy, what we technically mean is liberal democracy, and I use that phrase not in the colloquial sense that I think in the United States our media refers to liberals, meaning left-leaning, but more in the political science sense, where liberal represents a system of government where there's the rule of law, there are checks and balances, individual rights are protected, and majorities select representatives on a regular basis through elections. When you combine all of those elements, you get the system of government that political scientists would call liberal democracy, which is the dominant system of government, not just in the United States, but around the world, or at least has been for most of the last 70, 80 years. Although, as we could talk about it, that's been going into decline and has been challenged recently. But when people think about democracy, sometimes they think about the things I just noted. Sometimes they think about voting. Sometimes, as I was saying earlier, they think about freedom. And sometimes they just think about things being normal versus being extreme and weird. And one of the things that we saw in the 2022 midterms was you had the voters that you're alluding to, the voters, frankly, that decide elections in a extremely divided country that is modern America. Those voters, in the 2022 midterms, a lot of them split their tickets in places like Georgia, where, for example, moderate Republican or independent voters voted for Brian Kemp for governor, but rejected Herschel Walker for Senate. Were in Pennsylvania, where some of them voted for Mehmet Oz in a losing campaign for the Senate, but at much higher levels than they voted for Doug Mastriano in the governor's race. And when you looked at those ticket splitters, the thing that sort of distinguished Walker from Kemp in their mind was that Walker was just weird and extreme. Less that Kemp was willing to stand up to stop the steal and fight election denialism and would descend, quote unquote, liberal democracy. But there was just something about Walker that was just deviant from American politics and our system. And so I think if you look at what's playing out now in the presidential race, yes, you have a campaign and a movement led by Donald Trump that is fundamentally opposed to the idea of democracy, the idea of constitutional representative self-government, the idea of the rule of law.
Ian, you're describing a threat for which the locus is within the Republican Party. How do you make the case against the proposition, which you hear from Republicans, that this is simply a partisan issue?
Well, first off, I think it's important to recognize that in the modern era, in which we have seen a rise of authoritarian-minded leaders and factions around the world, and democracy going into retreat, that has come from both the left and the right. Typically, you see right-wing authoritarianism in places like Eastern Europe, and you see left-wing authoritarianism in places like Latin America. And so the threat to democracy knows no party. And it knows no particular ideology other than power. And people who are committed to power at the expense of the rule of law and at the expense of allowing publics to self-govern can come from either side of the spectrum. It happens to be the case that here in the United States, the dominant threat to our democracy is coming from a faction on the right that has largely captured the Republican Party. But it is important to point out that not all Republicans, certainly not all conservatives, are part of that faction. In fact, a lot of the defense of democracy in the recent years has come from conservatives and Republicans doing the right thing and playing the role of what's known as in-group moderates against the authoritarian faction within their own party. So you look, for example, at people like Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, who stood up to Trump's attempt to, quote-unquote, find 11,000 votes, or you look at people like Aaron Van Langeveld, the one Republican on the Michigan State Canvassing Commission, who in 2020 voted to certify the results and do his obligation under the law, his duty under enormous counter pressures from Donald Trump and the MAGA faction in the Republican Party. And you look at just recently, where you had more than 100 officials from Republican administrations, from Reagan up to and including Trump, come out and endorse Vice President Harris and point out just how dangerous it would be for our democracy if Donald Trump returned to power. So the movement to protect and preserve democracy in this country is a cross-ideological one that includes progressives, moderates, and conservatives. But we have to be explicit and clear, honest, candid, and direct about pointing out that the authoritarian faction on the right has captured the Republican Party. Its leader is the Republican nominee for president. And while there are illiberal movements on the left and risks of authoritarian behavior on the left, they remain at the fringes of the organized American left. They have not captured the Democratic Party, not even close. And so there is asymmetry here. And that's just the reality. And that's a fact. And we need to deal with that reality in order to preserve our democracy and navigate our way through it.
Let me ask you about the your accurate observation that this is happening around the world. it wasn't that long ago that the Berlin Wall fell and some people declared democracy had won. It's the end of history. Why now, more than 30 years later, why is this happening?
Well, if you look back historically, democracy has risen and fallen in a series of waves since its modern advent. So in the late 18th, early 19th century, democracy returns to the world after centuries of really not having been a prevalent form of government. And you get imperfect democracies in France and the United States initially, representative democracies, Republican and Democratic forms of government. And then those collapse into tyranny and dictatorship. Not all of them, some of them. And then you get another rise in the post-war period, where the European empires pull back and formerly colonized nations become independent. And a lot of them, 1960, the year of Africa, you get 12 new newly freed nations in Africa, many of which become democratic initially. And then, unfortunately, too many descend back into a less democratic, more authoritarian or tyrannical form of government. And then the third wave rises in the last quarter of the 20th century, the greatest wave yet. The most countries in human history become democratic, more people living under democratic governance. The fall of the Berlin Wall becomes kind of the climactic and pinnacle moment of that movement. And then, just like the waves before it, that wave goes backwards. And so, one, it's worth noting that in some ways, this was somewhat predictable if you looked at those patterns in history, that history is fluid. History is a dialectic between different forms of government and goes back and forth. And the good news there is that just as each wave has crashed, a new one has risen. And I think we should just as easily predict that a fourth wave will rise out of the ashes of this sort of crashing third wave. In terms of what has wrought the change, each of those errors, you know, it's something different, but I think we can point to a lot of different causes for the current recession of democracies, none of them necessarily being the dominant one, but changes in the information landscape have wrought havoc on understandings of truth and reality around the world. Climate change has driven conflict and changed migration patterns, where you're having changing demographics around the world that are leading to all sorts of climate disruptions and conflict. Globalization, changing labor markets, have created additional conflicts that have all of these and more have produced opportunities for demagogues to come in rapidly changing times when people are feeling anxious about the future and say, I alone can fix it. I know you're feeling anxious, but I can solve it all. And that snake oil has been sold many times in human history. And I think it gets sold at moments of major transition. And we're in a moment of major transition today.
Now, in the United States, this threat came into vivid focus in the months after the 2020 election, culminating in the violent insurrection on January 6th. As you think of what the threat principally amounts to, is it about the accurate counting of legitimately cast votes and the peaceful transfer of power, or is it a bigger thing than that?
It's bigger than that. It's fundamentally a question of what form of government we want to live in for this next stretch of American history. And I think we are witnessing two different dynamics come together, a supply and a demand problem. On the demand side, for the reasons that I just noted, there is a destabilization that people are legitimately and understandably feeling right now because of just how quickly the world is changing. And when people feel that rapid acceleration of change, it is normal to feel anxious about it. And in moments like that, people tend to be open to extreme offers of what could address their fears, their anxieties, and solve their problems. If you look at the early 20th century, when the Industrial Revolution and similar set of incredibly rapid changes were destabilizing the world, you had a rise in extremism on the left and the right. You had socialism and communism rise around the world. You had fascism on the right rise around the world. And you could see, if you looked on the European continent, for example, the pre-existing parties and coalitions begin to fracture as people were drawn to extremes as a way of providing something to that demand of what's going to address my deep anxieties about how quickly the world is changing. On the supply side, in moments like that, talented demagogues have an opening. And we saw them in the early 20th century with the rise of the fascist leaders in Europe. And we're witnessing it today, where we have an incredibly talented demagogue in Donald Trump use this opening and see that demand and supply it with a vision, his vision, of might makes right. Rules are for suckers. This is Donald Trump's instinctive belief about the world and about life. And because he believes in a world without rules, he could smash and grab more effectively than anyone else. To line his pockets, to aggrandize his ego, to give himself power for its own sake, he is trying to push that form of government. And the way that that manifests is in the things that you're talking about, attempts to overturn legitimate election results or storm the Capitol. But those are tactics in service of a broader vision of his, which is that a state of nature is one in which people like him can thrive and prosper, and he wants to drive us into that place. But as Hobbes warned us, the state of nature is one in which life is nasty, brutish, and short, and we don't want to go there, and it will be up to us to resist that.
Then presumably the authoritarian impulse comes from a group that feels aggrieved, but feels it can't win in a free election, that it needs to impose a kind of force to hold on to power.
You know, when we talked about some of the things that are driving this moment around the world, you know, I mentioned changing demographics, which are happening all around the world for a variety of different reasons, depending on the region. But fundamentally, our nation has been one in which power has historically been consolidated in the hands of, frankly, largely, you know, sort of white male Christian populations. And the story of America has been our long effort to more equitably distribute that power in keeping with the ideals and aspirations of our founding documents. And as that happens, there is a perception among those who have historically held outsized power that that they're losing out. And if you look at books like Barbara Walters' book, How Civil Wars Start. One of the number one causes for the breakdown of democracies and violent conflict is when a formerly dominant demographic group of people feel what Walter describes as backsliding of their social position in society. And there's some evidence from some research that was done on the 2016 election that backs up this notion, pointing to the fact that people who perceive social status loss, dominant, you know, white male Christian voters, that was one of the dominant predictors of their support for Donald Trump in 2016. And so we are going to have to pull something off in this country that really hasn't been pulled off in world history, which is to be able to sustain a truly inclusive, multiracial, multireligious, multiethnic democracy, which is extremely hard to do, but it has been the vision for America since our earliest days that we've never achieved. And the question I think before us is, are we going to do that? Are we going to earn the true exceptionalist label that Americans have always clung to? Or in the moment when we're almost there, are we going to fall backwards into something far, far darker?
Now, let me ask you about some things that have been done through the Democratic process in states since 2020. You've had a number of states change election rules, change the parameters for early voting or where ballots can be dropped off. You have right now an effort by Republicans in Nebraska to change the split electoral vote system they have, where there's a one congressional district awards its own electoral vote, regardless of what happens in the rest of the state. Do you look at those as legitimate because they're done through elected officials, or do you see them as part of a pattern that, in fact, does threaten democracy?
You know, I went back a couple of years ago and reread Democracy in America by de Tocqueville. And one passage stood out to me as so not just prescient, but telling about our current moment, which is de Tocqueville was looking at the structure of American government, you know, mere decades after the founding of the Constitution, and said, boy, you all better be really careful with this idea of this chief executive position, this presidency that you've created. It better not be too powerful, because if it is, every election will be a by any means necessary battle by all factions to control that post, and that will ultimately descend into irreparable conflict. And I looked at the world we're living in today, in which the American presidency over many, many decades under presidents of both parties has become far too powerful at the expense, in particular, of the legislative branch, with the founder, which the founders, you know, made the Article I branch for a reason. They wanted that to be the real central space for governing and lawmaking and policymaking in the country, more representative body. And you can see how, as the presidency has gotten more important, the stakes for presidential elections have gotten to such an extreme degree that both sides are willing to deploy by any means necessary tactics to capture it. And so you see things that are obviously and clearly violations, not just of the law, but of the spirit of our system. Things like what happened on January 6th, the violent storming of the Capitol instigated by the losing presidential candidate Donald Trump. But you also see things like what you're alluding to, which is the sort of bending and twisting and manipulating of legal processes in order to try to generate a desired outcome. Some degree of that is probably somewhat inevitable in a democratic system, but the degree of it we are seeing today is not really sustainable or tolerable. And it is a symptom of all of the problems that we've been talking about, and not one that we're going to want to see as sort of the steady state for American democracy going forward.
Now, we're less than 2 months from Election Day. Early voting has actually started in some states. I wonder what you actually expect to happen. Do you think that we will have an election in which legitimate votes are again freely and fairly counted, and that we will not have the stain of violence in the aftermath of the election or before the election?
So two things. I mean, I guess, you know, we're on here. Everybody's in the business of making political prognostications right now. So let me say, you know, about the race, how I view it is, I fundamentally, notwithstanding everything we've seen in recent years, I do have faith in the American people. And I do have faith that at the end of the day, even if it is by a far too small margin, the American people are going to reject the authoritarian vision of Donald Trump. I say that not just because of my beliefs that Americans at core, at root, do want to maintain a self-governing constitutional republic, but also just because of some of the fundamentals that are more sort of small P regular politics. I mean, we're living in a moment in which inflation has been beaten. Unemployment is at modern lows. The stock market is at record highs. Crime has plummeted. Border crossings are at the lowest point in years. More Americans have health coverage today than ever before. I mean, just the fundamentals of this moment in time suggest a better path for Vice President Harris.
I've got to say, it is a mystery to me why, at a time when objectively so many things in the nation are going in the right direction, a large majority of voters say we're going in the wrong direction. Why is that?
Well, I think, you know, we talked about the sort of changing of the information landscape. And look, at the end of the day, the way the founders assumed that the people, being sovereigns, would exercise this power, this awesome power of self-government, is that they would be informed about what is happening through a variety of mechanisms, the public education, or the education system, eventually becoming a public education system, and the media, which was the way that people would come to understand what is being done on their behalf by
the government. And I think while there have been really outstanding examples of journalism over the last couple of years, I will not to flatter you, but because this is the topic right now of what we're talking about, I will credit you, John, as having been someone who stood on principle on what the Fourth Estate was supposed to be doing and called it as you saw it. And you've been unflinching about the threats that you saw facing democracy. And I think you paid a price for it at a media enterprise that really fell down on the job. But notwithstanding all of the really good reporting that's been done, there's been a ton of it done. The overall failure of the media in this moment, I think, is one of the causes for this. And to be specific about it, I think there's two things that the media in recent years, media culture, have done that have led to this. One is there is just an excessive focus on criticism and what's going wrong rather than a focus on what's going right. And just, you know, a recent example of this, there was a moment about 3 or 4 weeks ago when foreign stock exchanges were taking a beating over the weekend. And the expectation was that when U.S. exchanges opened on Monday morning, we could be facing a Black Monday-like crash. And every newspaper, every media outlet in the country presaged sort of Monday's opening with the darkest, oh my God, collapse is imminent, recession is imminent, it's all going to hell, the whole place is collapsing. And that didn't happen. And a mere, I don't remember the exact timeline, but a week or more later, the market was again at record highs. And did you have the same level of coverage of that positive story? Not even a fraction of it. If it bleeds, it leads. And I think our media culture is one that focuses on the negative. And so that is one reason why people think things are going badly when they're not actually going as badly. And then, of course, the second is this misguided idea that the media's job is to be balanced between two competing sides, irrespective of whether the sides themselves deserve that balance based on their relationship to truth and reality. We need a media that is unbiased, but not neutral when it comes to truth and democracy. Nobody responsible is suggesting that the media should take sides between parties or candidates. I've seen straw men floated by those who are defending the media's position. I think A.G. Sulzberger makes this straw man argument way too frequently, that critics like me in moments like this are suggesting that if the Democratic candidate for governor in a given state robs a bank, the media shouldn't cover it because the media should be on the side of the Democratic candidate. Nobody is responsibly making that argument. That is not the point. The point is that if one side is barely attached to reality and regularly telling lies, and the other side is largely telling the truth, although sometimes, you know, sort of doing, as politicians have done, spins on it, those are very different. You got to cover them differently. And I think that's been another failure. I think it has led to a moment where people's perception of reality is quite divorced from some of these hard and fast numbers about where reality stands.
Do you expect violence around this election?
Well, we have been trending in the wrong direction when it comes to political violence in this country. And I think you and I agree, just to be very, very clear, there is no place for political violence in this country. There's no place for violence in a civilized society.
Trump says specifically that people warning about the threat to democracy may have inspired attempts on his life.
Yeah, that's just cynical BS. Because, listen, here's the reality is that our job as citizens in a self-governing democracy is to be on guard for potential abuses of power and to raise our voice in peaceful ways, but in very clear, candid, honest, direct ways, to call that out when we see it. That's what self-governing democracies do. That's how they're protected against danger, against attacks, frankly, even against violence, is to use peaceful means to say, hey, this is a threat. This person's platform is a threat. The things that they're suggesting they might do are a threat to our system of government. The notion that we shouldn't be saying that, that's dangerous. That would deprive us of one of the most important checks and tools we have against tyranny and to preserve democracy.
Ian, let's say your confidence is justified, and we do have a free and fair election, and we have a peaceful aftermath and transfer of power, as we've had in all of our modern elections, except for 2020. Will that be a moment for Americans to exhale about this threat and believe that it's less than people have feared? Or is that a moment to go after some structural reforms aimed at what people consider counter-majoritarian elements of our system, the Electoral College, the structure of the Senate, the filibuster, elements of the Supreme Court, first past the post election systems as compared to something like ranked choice voting? Are those structural things vital to resolve this problem or improve the situation?
I mean, I wish that we could exhale, and I know people would love if we get to that point to be able to sort of take a break from all of this, and maybe they can take a brief one, but unfortunately, we will be far from out of the woods. I fear that in a world in which the vice president does prevail, I think there's going to be ugly backlash to it. And so I think right off the bat, you're going to face some really turbulent moments in American history where there's going to be a sizable percentage of the population that is not going to accept that result. Certainly Donald Trump is not going to accept that result. And a good number of his followers are not going to accept that result. And we saw what happened when he lost the last time in 2020. It led to a violent storming of the Capitol. And that was when, frankly, according to polls taken right after the 2020 election, only a fraction of his followers believed his lies about having actually won the election. Today, the percentage of his followers that believe his lies about 2020 and will believe his lies this time if indeed he does lose is going to be far higher. And so extrapolate out from January 6, 2021 to what it looks like when a much more sizable percentage of his followers believe his tales, knowing that he's going to continue to tell them. So I think we are unfortunately probably in for still a rocky road, even in a Harris transition and Harris administration. And then, of course, as you note, it would be such a travesty if we got to the other side of the peak of the crisis and didn't reap the opportunity that this provides. And the opportunity, I think, that's before us is for a fourth founding. You know, this country has had three foundings. It had our original Constitution after the Revolution. It had the Reconstruction after the Civil War. It had the civil rights movement after the first half of the 20th century, the Depression, World War II, Jim Crow. And at each of those moments, we moved just a little bit closer to our founding ideals of having a truly representative democracy. And I think we're living through right now the crisis that will precede the fourth founding, where we do, as you note, update some of our systems to be fit for purpose for the 21st century. Most advanced democracies around the world have learned over the past 150 years ways in which their system could be more representative of the people, more inclusive of their populations, more resilient against danger, against extremist practices on all sides. And we are a laggard here in the United States. We are behind most of our peer democracies in having updated our system. Things like, you note, first past the post legislative races. No advanced democracy around the world chooses that anymore. And so I think moving to a system where more people get represented, where Republicans in Massachusetts get representation and Democrats in Oklahoma get representation. And there are systems where you can do that, more proportional-based systems. And then the most disenfranchised sort of ideological constituency right now is arguably traditional Republicans who are not MAGA, who don't support or believe in Donald Trump's authoritarian agenda, but are not Democrats either. They're center-right, they're more conservative, traditionally conservative-minded, and they're politically homeless right now. And having a way for them to have representation, I think, will also do wonders for moderating some of our politics. And so, for example, our organization, Protect Democracy, is litigating some cases in New Jersey. We just filed another one in Kansas to re-legalize the practice of fusion voting, which would allow parties like that to actually not be spoilers, but have a role in our politics. So I think there will be, hopefully, a window for reform, an important one to seize. And I fear also some continuing very, very serious challenges to the stability of our nation. So while maybe we'll be able to take a quick breath, there will be plenty of really urgent and important work to do, even in a Harris administration.
Well, what are the prospects of any of that work getting done when you consider that the Senate's going to be very evenly divided either way? The House probably quite evenly divided, although the House can do more things with a small majority than the Senate can. Do you have any sense of optimism that there is a coalition to be had, maybe including members of both parties, that could make some of the reforms that would strengthen that majoritarian muscle that has atrophied in certain ways?
I do, because the two reforms I just mentioned, fusion voting and sort of moving towards more proportional type systems, they don't depend on Congress. The fusion voting efforts that we've been a part of are about challenging bans on fusion voting as violating state constitutions. And those cases are going up to state Supreme Courts. And so that's not, Congress has anything to do with it. That's a question for states to decide whether the right to a freedom of association in those states requires some ability for small parties to nominate the same candidate as a major party has nominated. And then in terms of proportional representation, again, you know, this is going to be a state choice initially about experimenting with different forms of representation first, I think, at the state level. So I do think that there are pathways outside of Congress. And then even in a situation with a President Harris and a divided Congress, I think two things. One, we've seen some bipartisan reforms in this space. The passage of the Electoral Count Reform Act in the waning days of 2022 was a bipartisan reform effort that passed Congress. In fact, just recently, we've seen some really important reforms that would move powers back from the executive branch to the legislative branch, where they've gained too much power on the executive side recently when it comes to emergency powers, when it comes to war powers that have bipartisan support on the Hill. A reform to the National Emergencies Act passed recently with overwhelming bipartisan majorities out of committees in both the Democratic-controlled Senate and the Republican-controlled House. So I do think there are some prospects for reform. And in a world in which Donald Trump has lost, I'm hopeful, although a little bit like Charlie Brown with Lucy's football, I'm not betting on it. I'm hopeful that there will be a movement within the American right to retake portions of the Republican Party from MAGAism, if it turns out that it proves yet again to be a giant electoral loser.
To your point about state-level action, is there a realistic hope of getting the Electoral College Compact that some states have called for, where there's an agreement among states as to how to count their electoral votes?
Look, I think this is such an important conversation for the country to have. And, you know, I think that for anyone right now who is living in any of the 43 states that are not Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, and North Carolina, we rightfully might ask, hey, what's our role in this election? Don't we get candidates trying to win our votes based on the issues that are important to us if we live in Oklahoma or North Dakota or Connecticut? And I think for people in all 43 of those states, it's a really important question to ask, which is this really the best system? And I would commend people to Jesse Wegman's excellent book, Let the People Pick the President, which gets into the history of the Electoral College. And one of the most interesting things about that book is when the author goes and looks at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, what he finds is a very different story than the one that we've been told. You know, we've been told the story that the Electoral College was this grand compromise, this brilliant, Solomonic solution to bringing together small states and large states under one banner, one union. And in fact, when you go back and look at the history, that's not at all what happened. What happened was that during that very, very hot summer, one thing that's worth remembering in the early days of this country, hard to get purified water. And didn't have air conditioning. So when it was hot and you couldn't get purified water, what did people drink?
They drink beer. Our founders drank beer a lot. And so they're basically drinking a lot of beer that summer, and they can't solve the problem of how to elect the president. And they leave it, they punt it to be the last thing they come to at the very end of resolving all these contentious disputes. And at the very end of the waning days, where it's the last thing left, and they've had a lot of beer, and they want to get out of there, say, you know what, let's just go with this thing, this Electoral College thing, and be done with it. And they kind of just did it as a throw-in to end everything. And then one by one, in the following months and years, most of those leading figures who had been there in Philadelphia give statements saying, yeah, that was a mistake. And so the notion that the Electoral College was some sort of brilliant solution is apocryphal. And I think given the way this current election is playing out, where you know all the focus in recent years is just on a handful of states, a handful of people, I think it's worth a real national conversation about whether that's the right way to go.
Let me close with this question. If we are in the midst or the early stages of the fourth founding, as you call it, how long do you think that process plays out, and how will we know whether it succeeded?
So I think we're living, and this gets to your question about, is there a moment come January of next year when we can kind of exhale and sort of wipe our hands and say, we made it? And the reason I say no is each of these prior moments has been generational. And this moment is generational. The crisis and opportunity before us is our generation's charge in the American story to lead us over this incredible mountain that is before us and into a promised land on the other side of a more representative democracy. And that is not something that happens in one presidential cycle, two presidential cycles, or probably even three presidential cycles. It's going to be the dominant work of my generation and the generation that's coming after it. And I think when we get to a place where we have gone through multiple presidential cycles, I might look at three presidential cycles where neither major party candidate, or maybe if we're in a moment, ideally where there's multiple parties, has nominated somebody who is fundamentally opposed to a constitutional representative democratic form of government, that would be one objective metric for knowing that we've probably gotten to the other side of it. And I think there's a lot of change that we need to bring into being before that. But I think the good news is, if you look at public polls, the American public wants a change in our system. They want some of these reforms to fix. They fundamentally think something is no longer working in our system. And if we are to be responsive to that and to make sure that not just America as a nation, but America as an idea is as dominant around the world in the 21st century as it was in the 20th, then this is a baton we all need to pick up and carry. It's our task. It's our duty. This is our American heritage and hopefully the legacy we'll leave.
So if that baton passes the finish line, it's going to be in the hands of our grandkids, not us.
I want to make sure that when we give it to them, we give it to them in the best condition possible and with them in the best position to win this race.
Ian, thanks so much for being with us on Bedeviled. It's been a fascinating discussion.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Bedeviled. This podcast is possible because of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University. It's produced by Maria Luisa Fresson-Nori. Music from Blue Dot Sessions. You can listen to Bedeviled on all podcast platforms.